Disc 22. Another compelling explanation for the timing of Callender's exposé relates to Hamilton's Phocion essays the previous fall, which had delved openly for the first time into Jefferson's private life. On October 15, 1796, we recall, Hamilton had seemed to make reference to Sally Hemings. On October 19th, indulging in more heavy breathing, Hamilton said that Jefferson's simplicity and humility afford but a flimsy veil to the internal evidences of aristocratic splendor, sensuality, and Epicureanism. Then on October 23rd, the Jeffersonian Aurora had published an anonymous response that referred discreetly for the first time to the Reynolds affair. The message was addressed to Treasury Secretary Wolcott and asked whether he had not been privy in December 1792 to the circumstances of a certain inquiry of a very suspicious aspect respecting real malconduct on the part of his friend, patron, and predecessor in office, which ought to make him extremely circumspect on the subject of investigation. The author threatened to cite specifics. Would a publication of the circumstances of that transaction redound to the honor or reputation of the parties? And why has the subject been so long and carefully smothered up? Hamilton got the message. In subsequent installments of Phocion, he fell silent abruptly on the subject of Jefferson's sex life. The man making these menacing noises in the Aurora may have been John Beckley, recently ousted as clerk of the House of Representatives. Perhaps he leaked the Reynolds documents to Callender as revenge against the Federalists, or maybe he no longer felt morally bound to silence after resigning his job. Monroe himself fingered Beckley as the culprit. "You know, I presume, that Beckley published the papers in question," Monroe told Aaron Burr. It should be recalled, however, that Monroe had given the papers to Beckley in the first place, so Monroe was admitting to Burr that he had not ensured the secrecy of documents entrusted to him and had known all along that confidentiality had been breached. In holding James Monroe responsible, Alexander and Eliza were not off the mark. A shadowy operative, adept at intrigue, Beckley continued to move stealthily in the background of Republican Party politics. He is a type familiar in political history, the aide who lurks in the cloakrooms of power, listening and absorbing valuable information. Beckley had started out as clerk of the Virginia House of Delegates. Jefferson, then the governor, called him the ablest clerk in the country. As first clerk of the House of Representatives, Beckley was a protege of House Speaker Frederick Muhlenberg, which may also explain how he was drawn into the Reynolds scandal. Beckley's humble title did not capture the enormous power he wielded. Madison, Monroe, William Branch Giles, and other powerful Republicans gathered for talks at his lodgings. According to Hamilton's son, they once drank a mean-spirited toast to Hamilton when he was sick. A speedy immortality to Hamilton. Beckley had an unslakable thirst for political intelligence. Benjamin Rush said of Beckley that he possesses a fund of information about men and things, and what is more in favor of his principles, he possesses the confidence of our two illustrious patriots, Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison. Beckley was constantly trying to dig up derogatory information to satisfy the Republican fantasy that Hamilton and Washington headed a pro-British monarchical conspiracy. Jefferson never shed his intense admiration for Beckley. When elected president himself, he restored Beckley as clerk of the House of Representatives, and, loading him down with still more honors, appointed him the first librarian of Congress. Hamilton thought that Jefferson was one of the conspirators behind the Callender expose. Jefferson's secretary, William A. Burwell, said that around the time of the Mariah Reynolds revelation, Hamilton had threatened Jefferson with public exposure of a shameful episode many years earlier in which Jefferson had repeatedly tried to seduce Betsy Walker, the wife of his friend and Virginia neighbor John Walker. Perhaps for this reason, the conflicted Jefferson both subsidized Callender and also urged him to refrain from further attacks on Hamilton. Callender reported that Jefferson advised that the Reynolds papers should be suppressed, but his interposition came too late. Once Callender's charges were published, Hamilton faced an agonizing predicament. Should he ignore the accusations as beneath his dignity or openly rebut them? Friends recommended tactful silence. Wolcott urged Hamilton to defer a response, telling him of the indignation against those who have basely published this scandal. Jeremiah Wadsworth thought any defense would be fruitless, warning that it will be easy to invent new calumnies and you may be kept continually employed in answering. Deaf to such advice, Hamilton decided to respond at length. When it came to major decisions, he always trusted to his inner promptings. Ordinarily, he told associates, he would have ignored the slander, but Callender was insinuating that Muhlenberg, Venable, and Monroe had refused to believe him in 1792 when he said that his payments to James Reynolds involved adultery and extortion. Callender upped the stakes by warning Hamilton that if he printed only extracts from his correspondence with those three men, he would be accused of shading the truth. In an open letter on July 12th, he taunted Hamilton by saying the public have long known you as an eminent and able statesman. They will be highly gratified by seeing you exhibited in the novel character of a lover. Hamilton now reverted to lifelong practice. He would drown his accusers with words. In mid-July, he holed up in a Philadelphia boarding house with his friend, Congressman William Lawton Smith of South Carolina, among the tenants. As he confessed his sins, Hamilton probably did not want to face his family. One pictures him stooped over his desk, scratching away at a furious pace. According to Smith, Hamilton wrote with zest and a vengeful glee. He was in excellent health and in very excellent spirits, considering his complicated situation. Months earlier, Hamilton had complained to Smith of feeble health. Now he burst forth in fighting trim, striking a note of bravado as he confronted his enemies. This writing spree resulted in a 95-page booklet, 37 pages of personal confessions, supplemented by 58 pages of letters and affidavits. The volume is usually referred to as the Reynolds pamphlet, but the full title was Observations on Certain Documents Contained in No. 5 and No. 6 of the History of the United States for the year 1796, in which the charge of speculation against Alexander Hamilton, late Secretary of the Treasury, is fully refuted, written by himself. Before examining the specific charges against him, Hamilton placed Callender's pamphlets in a political context, identifying the true enemy as the spirit of Jacobinism. To accomplish its evil deeds, American Jacobinism had descended to calumny so that the influence of men of upright principles, disposed and able to resist its enterprises, shall be at all events destroyed. Thus, Hamilton tried to elevate his personal defense into another apocalyptic crusade to save the nation. After years of monetary sacrifices in public office, Hamilton again found it ruefully funny that he was accused of avarice. He said that his character had been marked by an indifference to the acquisition of property rather than an avidity for it. Then he got to the nub of the matter in the frankest confession yet uttered by an American public official. "The charge against me is a connection with one James Reynolds for purposes of improper pecuniary speculation. My real crime is an amorous connection with his wife, for a considerable time with his privity and connivance, if not originally brought on by a combination between the husband and wife with the design to extort money from me." Even at this late date, Hamilton wavered as to whether Maria Reynolds had colluded with her husband from the outset or only over time. If he had been a venal official, Hamilton jeered, he would have chosen a more important accomplice than James Reynolds. "It is very extraordinary if the head of the money department of a country, being unprincipled enough to sacrifice his trust and his integrity, could not have contrived objects of profit sufficiently large to have engaged the cooperation of men of far greater importance than Reynolds. And if he had conspired with Reynolds, he would not have passed along relatively petty sums of $50. Hamilton's strategy was simple. He was prepared to sacrifice his private reputation to preserve his public honor. He knew this would be the most exquisite torture for Eliza. Hadn't he just told William Hamilton that he could not be happier in a wife? And now here he was subjecting her to a nightmarish narrative of his betrayal. He wrote angrily of his accusers, "With such men, nothing is sacred. Even the peace of an unoffending and amiable wife is a welcome repast to their insatiate fury against the husband." We do not know whether Hamilton discussed his pamphlet with Eliza beforehand. After admitting to adultery, he made the following statement. This confession is not made without a blush. I can never cease to condemn myself for the pang which it may inflict in a bosom eminently entitled to all my gratitude, fidelity, and love. But that bosom will approve that even at so great an expense, I should effectually wipe away a more serious stain from a name which it cherishes with no less elevation than tenderness. The steadfast Eliza may have sympathized with Hamilton's wish to cleanse his name. Yet readers of the pamphlet must have wondered why, instead of settling for a brief apology and convincing mea culpa, Hamilton insisted upon telling the story in almost picaresque detail. He described Maria Reynolds coming to his door during the summer of 1791, of going around to her house that evening, and of being invited into her bedroom. Such descriptive touches, however much they gratified public curiosity, could only have mortified Eliza. All of Hamilton's breast beating. I have paid pretty severely for the folly and can never recollect it without disgust and self-condemnation, could not disguise that he was exposing Eliza to public humiliation. Why did Hamilton make this long, rambling confession? He was disgusted by the monstrous slurs upon his character and decided he would expose them once and for all. He intended to construct an account that would encompass all known facts and remove any room for misinterpretation by enemies. Moreover, Callender had already warned of the danger of publishing only extracts of the story. Far from being the subtle Machiavellian of Jeffersonian legend, Hamilton again suffered from excessive openness. No man ever more disdained duplicity or carried frankness further than he, Fisher Ames said. Hamilton was incapable of a wise silence. He probably imagined that the best way to prove the philandering and refute the corruption charges was to overwhelm his readers with details. As in all political battles, Hamilton was seized by an overmastering compulsion to counterattack with all the verbal weapons at his command. He viewed himself less as the guilty party than as the righteous one, unfairly maligned by scheming opponents, and he decided to turn the tables on his adversaries. Hamilton's antics had dazzled and appalled the country for years, and never more so than with the Reynolds pamphlet. His friends were agog at his faulty judgment. Humiliating in the extreme was the verdict of Henry Knox. Robert Troup observed that Hamilton's ill-judged pamphlet has done him inconceivable injury. William Lawton Smith thought Hamilton had rebutted Callender, yet it is afflicting to see so great a man dragged before the public in such a delicate situation and compelled to avow a domestic infidelity to an unfeeling world. Noah Webster wondered why someone of Hamilton's stature would publish a history of his private intrigues, degrade himself in the estimation of all good men, and scandalize a family to clear himself of charges which no man believed. Small wonder that Hamilton's family later tried to buy up and destroy all copies of the pamphlet left on the market. The Republican press had a field day with the pamphlet and battened off it for years. Henceforth, Hamilton would be viewed as the oversexed Treasury Secretary. Callender rejoiced at Hamilton's indiscretion, telling Jefferson, "If you have not seen it, no anticipation can equal the infamy of this piece. It is worth all that 50 of the best pens in America could have said against him." Drawing on this material, Callender wrote mockingly that the whole proof in this pamphlet rests upon an illusion. "I am a rake, and for that reason I cannot be a swindler." The Aurora responded similarly when it paraphrased Hamilton as saying, "I have been grossly charged with being a speculator, whereas I am only an adulterer. I have not broken the 8th commandment. It is only the 7th which I have violated." In sacrificing his private virtue, Hamilton had imagined he would at least preserve a spotless public record. He would have been disheartened by Jefferson's reaction. Writing to John Taylor, a Virginia politician, the circumspect Jefferson said that Hamilton's willingness to plead guilty to adultery seems rather to have strengthened than weakened the suspicions that he was in truth guilty of the speculations. Madison's reaction was more perceptive. "The publication is a curious specimen of the ingenious folly of its author. Next to the error of publishing it at all is that of forgetting that simplicity and candor are the only dress which prudence would put on innocence." For John and Abigail Adams, who already considered Hamilton a debauchee, their suspicions were fully confirmed. Before the pamphlet appeared, Abigail told her husband of Hamilton, "Oh, I have read his heart in his wicked eyes. The very devil is in them. They are lasciviousness itself." Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State, recalled that soon after Adams became president, Abigail called on Mrs. Pickering and took her to ride with her in her carriage. "My wife afterwards told me that Mrs. Adams dwelt on the licentiousness of Hamilton's character in regard to the female sex." When the scandal broke, the Adamses were probably less shocked at Hamilton's behavior than at his candor in admitting it. After they returned to Philadelphia in November 1797, fresh from a four-month absence, Abigail wrote of the Reynolds pamphlet, "Alas, alas, how weak is human nature." John Adams traced Hamilton's roguish deeds back to his days on Washington's staff, followed by debaucheries in New York and Philadelphia, at which he had made his audacious and unblushing attempts upon ladies of the highest rank and purest virtue. It is difficult to figure out if the charges of sexual profligacy made against Hamilton all trace back ultimately to Mariah Reynolds. There are only scattered references to his amorous ways in contemporary documents between the time of the affair, 1791-92, and its exposure, 1797, then a tremendous increase after Callender performed his dirty work. That Hamilton loved the ladies and had a high libido level seems clear. But was his adult life really a rake's progress of sexual conquests? For all the innuendos about adultery, he did not engage in indiscriminate sex, and we can connect him with only Mariah Reynolds for certain. There was plenty of understandable speculation about Angelica Church, but she was mostly abroad between 1783 and 1797, and we will never know whether her mutual enchantment with Hamilton was sexually consummated. One strong argument against such outright adultery was that Eliza and the entire Schuyler family adored Hamilton until the day he died. Would they have tolerated Hamilton if he had been sleeping with Eliza's sister? After Hamilton's death, the ever-vigilant John Beckley referred to Hamilton as a double adulterer, presumably referring to Mariah Reynolds and Angelica Church, but he named no one else. Alexander Hamilton was the most controversial public figure of his era. If he had other women, why didn't the scandal-loving Republican press refer to these other romances? It seems unlikely that if other women abounded, their identities would have been so well concealed for two centuries. And why, if Hamilton was so promiscuous, did he father no illegitimate children that we know of? For all the tongue clucking and finger wagging at Hamilton, the Reynolds scandal diminished but scarcely destroyed his political stature. Though the Reynolds pamphlet provided the Jeffersonian press with fodder for satire, it did not lead to a wholesale abandonment of Hamilton by the Federalists. As David Cobb, a Federalist judge from Massachusetts, told Henry Knox, "Hamilton is fallen for the present, but if he fornicates with every female in the cities of New York and Philadelphia, he will rise again. For purity of character after a period of political existence is not necessary for public patronage." In later years, John Adams conducted a revealing exchange of letters with William Cunningham, who said that Hamilton's friends had not abandoned him for straying from his wife. He offered an analogy from Roman history, the patriot Cato. Cato valued himself on his integrity and was, it is said, addicted to intemperance. But the friends of Cato prized him so highly for his main excellence that they looked upon his occasional intoxication with indulgence. Thus I have understood it of Hamilton. He set the estimation made of his uprightness against that which might be formed of the confession of his lewdness, and he determined that the weight of his cardinal virtues would preponderate over every defect and forever keep that scale immovably down. Perhaps the most telling reaction to Hamilton's troubles came from Washington, who knew Hamilton better than any other public figure. On August 21st, from out of the blue, he sent his beleaguered friend a gift along with a note that made no reference to the scandal. "Not for any intrinsic value the thing possesses, but as a token of my sincere regard and friendship for you, and as a remembrance of me, I pray you to accept a wine cooler for 4 bottles. I pray you to present my best wishes, in which Mrs. Washington joins me, to Mrs. Hamilton and the family, and that you would be persuaded that with every sentiment of the highest regard, I remain your sincere friend and affectionate, honorable servant." The letter was eloquent for what it did not say. It confirmed that Washington thought Hamilton was being persecuted and that he wanted to express solidarity with him. The wine cooler would always be treasured by Eliza Hamilton. That she cherished this gift so much tells us something about her view of the Mariah Reynolds scandal. For Hamilton and his descendants, the villain of the piece was always James Monroe. Hamilton's grandson blamed the exposure of the Reynolds affair on the mean traps laid for him, principally by Monroe. During the summer of 1797, Hamilton figured out pretty quickly that Monroe had made the Reynolds papers available to John Beckley in 1792. In his History of the United States for the year 1796, Callender had reproduced a statement by Muhlenberg, Venable, and Monroe about their dramatic confrontation with Hamilton on December 15, 1792, but now quoted them as saying that they had left Hamilton that evening under an impression our suspicions were removed. This implied that they had not really believed Hamilton. Still more damaging was a private memo, published by Callender, that Monroe had written on January 1, 1793. It reported on a meeting at which Jacob Clingman told Monroe that the putative romance between Hamilton and Mariah Reynolds was a mere fabrication to cover up Hamilton's wrongdoing at Treasury. By reporting this conversation without comment, Monroe seemed to lend tacit credence to its contents. Now, Hamilton promptly wrote and asked the three legislators to repudiate Callender's interpretation of the December 1792 meeting. Muhlenberg sent a friendly reply, regretted publication of the Reynolds papers, and confirmed that he had trusted Hamilton's account at the time. Venable's response, if a bit testier, agreed that the trio had accepted Hamilton's explanation. He also imparted the key piece of information that the Reynolds documents had been entrusted to James Monroe. I do not know any means by which these papers could have got out unless by the person who copied them, that is, John Beckley. Monroe received Hamilton's letter just as he was preparing to visit his New York in-laws, the Courtwrights. Before replying, Monroe wanted to huddle with Muhlenberg and Venable. Miffed by what he saw as stalling, Hamilton flew into a rage when he heard that Monroe was staying near him on Wall Street. On July 10th, he sent Monroe a terse note. Mr. Hamilton requests an interview with Mr. Monroe at any hour tomorrow forenoon which may be convenient to him. Particular reasons will induce him to bring with him a friend to be present at what may pass. Mr. Monroe, if he pleases, may have another. Beyond its cold formality, the note's reference to bringing witnesses signified the potential onset of an affair of honor. Faced with this challenge, Monroe consented to have Hamilton come to his lodgings at 10 o'clock the next morning. It was to be one of the most emotional encounters of Hamilton's tumultuous life. James Monroe was a tall, handsome man with piercing blue eyes and a rather awkward manner. Unlike the quick-witted Hamilton, Monroe was a plodding speaker and a middling intellect. Jefferson and other companions valued his sincerity. "Turn his soul wrong side outwards and there is not a speck on it," Jefferson once told Madison. Like Hamilton, Monroe, a carpenter's son who had fought courageously in the Revolution, came from humble origins. He had crossed the Delaware with Washington, and his lung had been pierced by a bullet at the Battle of Trenton. By war's end, Monroe was a protege of Jefferson, who urged him to study law and enter politics. The two Virginians shared a belief that emancipation should be postponed, with the freed slaves someday transplanted to Africa. As a member of the Confederation Congress in the early 1780s, Monroe drew close to Madison but voted against ratifying the Constitution at the Virginia Convention. In the Senate, Monroe had exhibited special fervor in the Republican cause, just as Madison did in the House. He dismissed Britain as a corrupt, tottering state, saw the Federalists as their spineless lackeys. He denounced Hamilton's programs as calculated to elevate the government above the people, and favored an outright military alliance with France. For Monroe, the enemies of the French Revolution were likewise partisans for monarchy in America. 5 days after Monroe arrived in Paris as American minister, Robespierre was executed, but all the carnage did not cool Monroe's infatuation for the Revolution. He frequently sided with the French government, advised it to ignore Washington as an Angloman, and opposed the Jay Treaty. After 2 years of such disloyal bungling, Monroe was recalled by Washington and chastised as a mere tool in the hands of the French government. Hamilton arrived on the morning of July 11th with John B. Church, while Monroe invited along David Gelston, a New York merchant and Republican politician. Gelston left a graphic account of the showdown between the ex-Treasury Secretary and the future president. From the second he entered the room, Hamilton seemed beside himself with rage. In Gelston's words, he appeared very much agitated and launched into an extended monologue about the December 1792 meeting. Even in Gelston's neutral chronicle, one can feel the extreme tension throbbing in the air. The two antagonists were visibly offended by each other. Hamilton pointed out that he had written to Monroe, Muhlenberg, and Venable, and had expected an immediate answer to so important a subject in which his character, the peace and reputation of his family, were so deeply interested. Monroe replied that if Hamilton would be temperate or quiet for a moment, he would answer him candidly. Hamilton asked if Monroe had leaked the Reynolds papers or failed to guarantee their security. Monroe replied that he thought the documents had remained sealed with a Virginia friend, that he had not intended to publish them, and knew nothing of their appearance until his return from Europe. At this, Hamilton dropped any pose of civility and chastised Monroe, saying, "Your representation is totally false." According to Gelston, the two men rose instantly. Monroe called Hamilton a scoundrel, whereupon Hamilton immediately adopted the ritual language of dueling, saying, "I will meet you like a gentleman." To which Monroe retorted, "I am ready. Get your pistols." The two men, like a pair of squabbling schoolboys, nearly came to blows, and Gelston and Church had to pry them apart, urging moderation. Although they soon sat down, Gelston observed that Hamilton was still extremely agitated, while Monroe adopted an icy tone of contempt, telling Hamilton he would explain what he knew if the latter would just calm down. Gelston brought the hour-long meeting to a close by saying that Hamilton should wait until Monroe met with Venable and Muhlenberg in Philadelphia. Hamilton agreed reluctantly. This began an interminable correspondence between Hamilton and Monroe that lasted the rest of the year and never gave Hamilton satisfaction. After Monroe conferred with Muhlenberg in Philadelphia, Venable having left for Virginia, the two men drafted a joint letter to Hamilton. They agreed that in December 1792, they had credited his story about Mariah Reynolds and had dropped their suspicions about Treasury misconduct. This letter removed one bone of contention and took Muhlenberg out of the picture. But it left Hamilton brooding about another piece of evidence, the January 1, 1793 statement in which Monroe seemed to endorse Jacob Clingman's wild allegation. Hamilton followed Monroe to Philadelphia and peppered him with brief, pointed letters, trying to get him to renounce that statement. "Alexander Hamilton has favored this city with a visit," the Aurora reported with hearty pleasure. "He has certainly not come for the benefit of the fresh air." Because Monroe had been responsible for the document surfacing, Hamilton lectured him that it was incumbent upon him, as a man of honor and sensibility, to have come forward in a manner that would have shielded me completely from the unpleasant effects brought upon me by your agency. This you have not done. Hamilton then employed language that again presaged a duel. "The result in my mind is that you have been and are actuated by motives towards me malignant and dishonorable." Monroe was enraged by Hamilton's truculence. He told Hamilton that if he wanted to convert this dispute into a personal affair, in other words, a duel, he was fully prepared to oblige him. He took refuge behind a hair-splitting distinction. He said that while he had recorded Clingman's statement without comment, he had not endorsed it. In a stinging rejoinder, Hamilton pointed out that for Monroe to have recorded and preserved in secret this accusatory statement was scarcely a friendly action. At this juncture in late July, Hamilton was weighing whether or not to publish his pamphlet. Monroe's obstinacy apparently pushed him over the edge. "The public explanation to which I am driven must decide, as far as public opinion is concerned, between us," Hamilton told him. "Painful as the appeal will be in one respect, I know that in the principal point it must completely answer my purpose." In early August, the feud between Hamilton and Monroe took on the formality of an affair of honor. Both men denied wanting to duel, but stood ready if necessary. What are we to make of all this blowing and bluster? In their endless exchange of letters that summer, Monroe could have let Hamilton off the hook by stating that the veracity of the Clingman memo rested on Clingman's credibility alone. But Monroe was still smarting over his ignominious recall from Paris and did not wish to make life easy for Hamilton. On the other hand, it is equally noteworthy that Hamilton was intransigent and made it hard for Monroe to compromise without losing face. On August 6th, Monroe sent Aaron Burr a copy of his correspondence with Hamilton and tried to enlist his aid to avert a duel. Obviously, he thought Burr was friendly enough with Hamilton to act as a mediator. Monroe made it plain that while he would not shrink from a duel, he would gladly avoid one if done with propriety. Just as Hamilton thought Monroe was motivated by partisan purposes, so Monroe thought Hamilton goaded on by party friends. "In truth, I have no desire to persecute this man," Monroe told Burr, "though he justly merits it. I had no hand in the publication, was sorry for it, and think he has acted by drawing the public attention to it and making it an affair of more consequence than it was in itself, very indiscreetly." Monroe did not understand just how upset the illegitimate Hamilton was about anything that affected his reputation. In a letter delivered by Burr, Monroe told Hamilton that he had no intention of challenging him to a duel. At this, Hamilton temporarily backed down, saying that any further action on his own part would be improper. The most fair-minded advice in the dispute came from Aaron Burr, who seemed devoid of the petty, vindictive spirit that actuated the chief adversaries. Unlike the Jeffersonians, he did not doubt Hamilton's integrity. That August, he told Monroe that he hoped his correspondence with Hamilton would be burned. "If you and Muhlenberg really believe, as I do and think you must, that Hamilton is innocent of the charge of any concern in speculation with Reynolds, it is my opinion that it will be an act of magnanimity and justice to say so in a joint certificate. Resentment is more dignified when justice is rendered to its object." Had he already hated Hamilton, Burr could have egged on Monroe and engineered a duel in which Hamilton might have died. Instead, he had the grace and decency to plead for fairness toward Hamilton. He was the one upright actor in the whole affair. In late August, the appearance of Hamilton's observations pamphlet revived the feud with Monroe, which sputtered on for months. After poring over the pamphlet, Madison reassured Monroe that it did not threaten his honor. Monroe would not listen. In early December, he reactivated the dormant feud by sending a provocative letter to Hamilton. "In my judgment," he told Hamilton, "you ought either to have been satisfied with the explanations I gave you or to have invited me to the field of honor." Burr was authorized to act as a second in any duel, but let the matter quietly lapse. Among other things, Burr did not think that Hamilton would actually fight, a misperception that may have influenced his later decisions in his own encounter with Hamilton. In fact, Hamilton drafted a letter to Monroe in January 1798, accepting a duel if necessary. Fortunately, the confrontation petered out, and Hamilton never sent the note. As a result of this and other dealings with him, Burr came away with a lower opinion of Monroe. When Monroe's name later surfaced as a possible presidential candidate, Burr jotted down this scathing assessment of him: "Naturally dull and stupid, extremely illiterate, indecisive to a degree that would be incredible to one who did not know him, pusillanimous and, of course, hypocritical, has no opinion on any subject and will be always under the government of the worst men. Pretends, as I am told, to some knowledge of military matters, but never commanded a platoon, nor was ever fit to command one." As a lawyer, Monroe was far below mediocrity. The first advertisement for Hamilton's pamphlet appeared in the Gazette of the United States on July 31st, yet it was not actually printed until August 25th. Why this curious hiatus after Hamilton had rushed to complete his defense? Some time may have elapsed as Hamilton rounded up affidavits, but the paramount reason was probably simpler. Eliza was pregnant with their sixth child. Because of her earlier miscarriage, it would be their first child in 5 years. Hamilton must have dreaded that exposure of his actions might provoke another miscarriage, as had occurred when he rode off to the Whiskey Rebellion 3 years earlier. Hamilton's delay in issuing his pamphlet gave Eliza the necessary reprieve. On August 4th, 1797, she gave birth to a healthy baby, William Stephen Hamilton, who was baptized by the Reverend Benjamin Moore at Trinity Church. "Mrs. Hamilton has lately added another boy to our stock," Hamilton told Washington in late August, after receiving the wine cooler. "She and the child are both well." The name may have celebrated Hamilton's new rapport with his Scottish uncle and paid tribute to his brother-in-law, Lieutenant Governor Stephen Van Rensselaer, then grieving over the death of his eldest daughter. The Republican press made the Reynolds expose as hellish as possible for Eliza. "Art thou a wife?" the Aurora asked her. "See him whom thou hast chosen for the partner of this life, lolling in the lap of a harlot." Eliza never commented publicly on the Reynolds scandal, but we can deduce her general reaction from several snippets of information. On July 13th, while Hamilton was in Philadelphia, John Barker Church sent him a letter that described Eliza's response to the open letter just published by Callender. "Eliza is well. She put into my hand the newspaper with James Thompson Callender's letter to you, but it makes not the least impression on her, only that she considers the whole knot of those opposed to you to be scoundrels." This drives home several points. That Eliza was outraged at Hamilton's critics, that she agreed that a conspiracy was afoot, and that her faith in her husband's integrity was unshaken. Of course, at this point, Hamilton had not yet published his own pamphlet, spilling out lurid details of his adultery. The Aurora later screamed, "He acknowledges that he violated the sacred sanctuary of his own house by taking an unprincipled woman during the absence of his wife and family to his bed." But already Eliza showed flashes of the militant loyalty to her husband that was to distinguish her widowhood. Church also mentioned to Hamilton that Angelica was sick. "My Angelica is not very well. She complains that her throat is a little sore. I hope it will not be of long duration." While Hamilton was pouring out his confessions in Philadelphia, he showed a special solicitude for Eliza. He knew that his pamphlet, at least temporarily, would shatter her heroic image of him, and he must have trembled with apprehension. He wrote to Eliza that he eagerly looked forward to her embrace and to the company of our beloved Angelica. "I am very anxious about you both. You for an obvious reason, and her because Mr. Church mentioned in a letter to me that she complained of a sore throat. Let me charge you and her to be well and happy, for you comprise all my felicity. Adieu, Angel." 2 days later, Hamilton wrote again and said he would return to New York the next day. "Love to Angelica and Church," he wrote. "I shall return full freighted with it for my dear brunettes." Eliza decided to have the baby in Albany. A guilt-ridden Hamilton escorted her to the sloop that transported her up the Hudson, but he did not join her. Probably his presence was then too distressing. Angelica saw Hamilton right after he returned from the boat, and she sent Eliza a consoling note. Angelica always wrote to her as the worldly, protective older sister, often calling her "my dear child." She knew Eliza was pure-hearted and easily wounded. On the other hand, Angelica was willing to make allowances for her brother-in-law. When Hamilton returned from the sloop, he was very much out of spirits, and you were the subject of his conversation the rest of the evening. Catherine, Angelica's daughter, played at the harpsichord for him, and at 10 o'clock he went home. "Tranquilize your kind and good heart, my dear Eliza, for I have the most positive assurance from Mr. Church that the dirty fellow who has caused us all some uneasiness and wounded your feelings, my dear love, is effectually silenced. Merit, virtue, and talents must have enemies and are always exposed to envy, so that, my Eliza, you see the penalties attending the position of so amiable a man. All this you would not have suffered if you had married into a family less near the sun. But then you would have missed the pride, the pleasure, the nameless satisfactions." Angelica signed the note, "with all my heart and redoubled tenderness." Eliza did not buckle under the strain. One imagines that she had tolerated some discreet philandering from Hamilton before, but not such open scandal. Did she see life with Hamilton the way Angelica did? That marriage to such an exceptional man entailed a large quota of pain and suffering that was abundantly compensated by his love, intelligence, and charm? The rest of her life suggests that this was indeed the case. The publication of Hamilton's pamphlet must have been inexpressibly mortifying to Eliza when she discovered how vulgar and uneducated Mariah Reynolds was, and how breezily Hamilton had deceived her during the affair, urging her to stay in Albany for her health. Whatever pain she suffered, however, Eliza never surrendered her conviction that her husband was a noble patriot who deserved the veneration of his countrymen and had been crucified by a nefarious band. Her later work for orphans, The decades spent compiling her husband's papers and supervising his biography, her constant delight in talking about him, her pride in Washington's wine cooler, her fight to stake Hamilton's claim to authorship of the farewell address. These and many, many other things testify to unflinching love for her husband. And the most convincing proof of all was the undying hatred that she bore for James Monroe. Just a couple of weeks after Hamilton published the Reynolds pamphlet, he experienced a medical scare with his eldest son, Philip, that may have seemed like heavenly retribution for his wayward conduct. The 15-year-old Philip, an uncommonly handsome and intelligent boy, was the most promising of the children. In early September, he was attacked with severe bilious fever, which soon assumed a typhus character, said Dr. David Hossack, a professor of medicine and botany at Columbia College, who was summoned to attend the boy. Hamilton had to leave for Hartford, Connecticut, to represent New York State in a case in federal court. As soon as he reached Rye, 30 miles north of New York City, he wrote to his wife in a state of distress. "I am arrived here, my dear Eliza, in good health, but very anxious about my dear Philip. I pray heaven to restore him and in every event to support you." He recommended a cold bath treatment not unlike the one used by Edward Stevens to cure him of yellow fever. "Also, my Betsy, how much do I regret to be separated from you at such a juncture? When will the time come that I shall be exempt from the necessity of leaving my dear family? God bless my beloved and all my dear children. A.H." As Philip's condition worsened, Hossack began to despair of his survival. Eliza grew so distraught that the good doctor banished her to another room so that she might not witness the last struggles of her son. He sent an express courier to fetch Hamilton from Hartford so he would arrive before the boy died. Meanwhile, Philip grew delirious, lost his pulse, and became comatose. Hossack managed to revive him by immersing him in hot baths of Peruvian bark and rum, then wrapping him in warm, dry blankets. Hossack later described Hamilton's return as one of his most gratifying moments as a physician. In the course of the night, General Hamilton arrived at his home under the full expectation that his son was no more. But to his great joy, he still lived. When the father knew what had been done and the means that had been employed, he immediately came to my room where I was sleeping, and although I was then personally unknown to him, awakened me, and taking me by the hand, his eyes suffused with tears of joy, he observed, "My dear sir, I could not remain in my own house without first tendering to you my grateful acknowledgement for the valuable services you have rendered my family in the preservation of my child." Hossack paid tribute to the tender feeling and exquisite sensibility that Hamilton showed as he assumed the role of maternal care. In tending his son, Hamilton was both nurse and physician, leaving the doctor amazed both by his medical knowledge and tenderness toward his children. Hossack recalled, "From that moment, he devoted himself most assiduously to the care of his son, administering with his own hand every dose of medicine or cup of nourishment that was required. I may add that this was his custom in every important case of sickness that occurred in his family." This was not a family that Hamilton was prepared to abandon, and whether from penance for the Reynolds affair or from his usual paternal dedication, he was very attentive to Eliza and the children in the coming years. Chapter 31, An Instrument of Hell. One reason that Hamilton so feared the repercussions of the Reynolds affair was a premonition that the United States might soon be at war with an imperious France. If this conflict came about, Hamilton intended to assume a major position and could not afford any hint of scandal. As many Republicans had predicted, the French had retaliated against the Jay Treaty by allowing their privateers to prey on American ships carrying contraband cargo bound for British ports. With Napoleon emerging as the new French military strongman, Hamilton had little doubt that his troops would spread despotism across Europe. Riding under Americus, Hamilton had warned early in 1797 that the specious pretense of enlightening mankind and reforming their civil institutions is the varnish to the real design of subjugating other nations. Hamilton predicted that France would become the terror and the scourge of nations. Soon after being sworn in as president, John Adams learned that the Directory, the five-member council now ruling France, had expelled the new American minister, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, and promulgated belligerent new orders against America's merchant marine. By spring, the French had seized more than 300 American vessels. To lift domestic morale, Hamilton suggested to Secretary of State Pickering a day of prayer to strengthen religious ideas in a contest that might pit Americans against atheism, conquest, and anarchy. Not trusting to the Lord alone, Hamilton also recommended more muscular measures, principally a new naval force and a 25,000-man provisional army. Far from being a reflexive warmonger, Hamilton wanted to explore first every diplomatic option. My opinion is to exhaust the expedience of negotiation and at the same time to prepare vigorously for the worst, he advised Oliver Wolcott Jr. Real firmness is good for everything. Strut is good for nothing. He told William Lawton Smith, My plan ever is to combine energy with moderation. President Adams decided to pursue a two-pronged strategy, maintaining American neutrality through negotiations while simultaneously expanding the military in case talks with France miscarried. He entertained the anodyne hope that he could thread a neat path between Federalist Anglophiles and Republican Francophiles. Like Adams, Hamilton wanted to preserve peace with France through diplomacy and possibly even negotiate a commercial treaty on the Jay Treaty model. In a high-minded mode, he urged that a bipartisan three-man commission be sent to France that included an old political rival. Unless Mr. Madison will go, there is scarcely another character that will afford advantage, he said. Despite heated protests from some Federalists, Hamilton thought that any delegation lacking a prominent Republican would forfeit all credibility with the French. He also yearned to call the Republicans bluff and show that the Federalists had done everything possible to conserve peace. Nevertheless, the three members of Adams's cabinet, under Hamilton's supposed dominion, Pickering, Wolcott, and McHenry, steadfastly opposed the choice of a Republican. Wolcott did more than just defy Hamilton's wishes. He threatened to resign if Adams executed such a policy. As Hamilton suspected, Madison, who had a deathly fear of transatlantic travel, turned down the chance to join the delegation to France, as did Jefferson. Starting with this first crisis of the Adams administration, Hamilton answered interminable queries from the Secretaries of State, Treasury, and War, who sought his guidance and shared with him internal cabinet documents. Ensconced in his Manhattan law office, Hamilton was apprised of everything happening in Philadelphia. Adams knew nothing of these contacts. At first, Hamilton did not denigrate Adams or his cabinet and behaved in exemplary fashion. I believe there is no danger of want of firmness in the executive, he told Rufus King. If he is not ill-advised, he will not want prudence. Vice President Jefferson, by contrast, was already in the thick of a secret campaign to sabotage Adams in French eyes. The French consul in Philadelphia, Joseph Letombe, held four confidential talks with Jefferson in the spring of 1797, talks no less unorthodox than the ones Hamilton had held with British Minister George Hammond, and informed his superiors in Paris, paraphrasing Jefferson, that Mr. Adams is vain, suspicious, and stubborn, of an excessive self-regard, taking counsel with nobody. Jefferson predicted to Letombe that Adams would last only one term and urged the French to invade England. In the most brazen display of disloyalty, he advised the French to stall any American envoys sent to Paris. Listen to them and then drag out the negotiations at length and mollify them by the urbanity of the proceedings. Jefferson and other Republicans encouraged the French to believe that Americans sided with them overwhelmingly, and this may have toughened the tone that the Directory adopted with the new administration. On May 16, 1797, President Adams delivered a bellicose message to Congress, denouncing the French for rejecting Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and stalking American ships and chiding them for having inflicted a wound in the American breast. He also announced plans to expand the Navy and bolster the militias. For the Aurora, this suggested too much belligerence. After a Pacific inaugural speech, editorialized the paper about Adams, we see him gasconading like a bully, swaggering the hero, and armed cap-a-pie, throwing the gauntlet to the most formidable power on earth. Ergo, Adams must be a British agent. We behold him placing himself the file leader of a British faction and marshaling his forces as if he were the representative of George III instead of the chief magistrate of the American people. Dashing this Republican stereotype, Adams made a conciliatory overture and announced plans to dispatch a diplomatic mission to Paris. The three-man delegation was to include two Southern Federalists, John Marshall and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, and a Northern Republican, Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, who had been a partisan of the French Revolution. "The French are no more capable of a Republican government," Adams advised Gerry, "than a snowball can exist a whole week in the streets of Philadelphia under a burning sun." Quite unlike the cabinet members he reputedly controlled, Hamilton applauded Adams with gusto. "I like very well the course of executive conduct in regard to the controversy with France," he told Wolcott. But he had reservations about the likely outcome of the mission. He believed that Adams had erred by not sending a Southern Republican, a move that would have convinced the French that the deck was not stacked against them. He also doubted that French officials would treat the American envoys respectfully, and fulminated against them as the most ambitious and horrible tyrants that ever cursed the earth, rebuking Republicans who would make us lick the feet of her violent and unprincipled leaders. When the American commissioners arrived in France in August 1797, they were greeted by a lame minister of foreign affairs who had been a pariah a few years earlier, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand Périgord, who had befriended Hamilton in Philadelphia. With the end of the Terror, Talleyrand had been rehabilitated and returned to France. Hamilton knew that he was avaricious and regarded public office as a means of obtaining money. The cynical Frenchman once told a mutual friend that he found it very strange that a man of his, Hamilton's, quality, blessed with such outstanding gifts, should resign a ministry in order to return to the practice of law and give as his reason that as a minister he did not earn enough to bring up his 8 children. After Hamilton returned to New York, Talleyrand was en route to a dinner party one night when he glimpsed Hamilton toiling by candlelight in his law office. "I have seen a man who made the fortune of a nation laboring all night to support his family," he said, shocked. After becoming French foreign minister in July 1797, he rejoiced at the plunder placed at his fingertips. "I'll hold the job," he confided to a friend. "I have to make an immense fortune out of it, a really immense fortune." He proceeded to scoop up an estimated 13 to 14 million francs during his first 2 years as foreign minister alone. By the time the three Americans showed up in Paris, Napoleon had crushed the Austrian army in Italy. Then, in early September, the Directory staged a veritable coup d'état, arresting and deporting scores of deputies and shutting down more than 40 newspapers in a wholesale purge of moderate elements. John Marshall sent a gloomy assessment to Pickering. "All power is now in the undivided possession of those who have directed against us those hostile measures of which we so justly complain." Corruption, long endemic among French officials, had only worsened under the Directory. When Talleyrand received the three American commissioners in October, he treated them civilly during a 15-minute audience, but they did not hear from him again for another week. The tone then turned frigid as Talleyrand explained that the Directory was excessively exasperated by statements made about France by President Adams in his May 16th address to Congress. Talleyrand then forced the three Americans to deal with three minions, Jean-Conrad Hottinguer, Pierre Bellamy, and Lucien Hauteval, who were to become infamous in American history through the three coded letters X, Y, and Z that identified them in diplomatic dispatches sent to Philadelphia. Through these underlings, Talleyrand imposed a series of insufferable demands: that President Adams retract the controversial passages of his truculent speech, extend a large loan to France, and even pay for damage inflicted on American ships by French privateers. Talleyrand's lieutenants further insisted that the Americans fork over a considerable bribe as the prelude to any negotiations. Playing a cat-and-mouse game, Talleyrand deferred meetings with the American envoys, allowing extra time for his intermediaries to extort money. John Marshall and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney were disgusted and wanted to terminate the negotiations at once. "Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute," Pinckney allegedly protested, while the Francophile Elbridge Gerry counseled patience. Marshall began drafting 2 long accounts to Timothy Pickering that chronicled the indignities they had endured. Due to the absence of winter traffic across the North Atlantic, the dispatches did not arrive in Philadelphia until the spring. While Adams awaited the results, Jefferson continued to make mischief by urging France to put off talks with the American delegation. The vice president still argues that the Directory has everything to gain here by temporizing, and he repeats to me incessantly that Machiavelli's maxim, nil repente, never repent, is the soul of great affairs, Letombe told his French bosses. Not until March 4, 1798, did Marshall's explosive narratives land on President Adams's desk. Once decoded, they made for shocking reading. The mission had been a disaster, nothing short of a grand national humiliation. After receiving an account of Talleyrand's chicanery, Hamilton advised Pickering, "I wish to see a temperate but grave, solemn, and firm communication from the President to the two houses on the result of the advices from our commissioners." Still willing to leave the door to talks open, Hamilton laid out an ambitious program for an enlarged army. "The attitude of calm defiance suits us," he told Pickering. At first, President Adams made a politics speech to Congress that announced that the mission had foundered while omitting the notorious circumstances that would have riled the public. He asked for a broad array of military preparations. In a serious miscalculation, the Republicans branded Adams a warmonger and claimed that France had behaved far better than the president was allowing. Vice President Jefferson referred privately to Adams's speech as an insane message. On March 29, 1798, Hamilton's old foe, William Branch Giles of Virginia, intimated that Adams was suppressing documents that would show France in a more flattering light. When he and other Republicans demanded the release of the communiques, the House agreed. Hamilton was pleased that France would now be shown in its true colors. "Americans at large should know the conduct of the French government towards our envoys and the abominable corruption of that government together with their enormous demands for money. These are so monstrous as to shock every reasonable man when he shall know them." When the XYZ papers were published, they proved a bonanza for the Federalists, and John Adams attained the zenith of his popularity as president. Although he had no military background, he now began to appear in military regalia, exhorting his followers to adopt a warlike character. After Adams dined with a delegation of patriotic admirers from New York in late May, Abigail gave each visitor a black cockade, a knot of ribbons, which became the emblem of support for the administration. "The act has produced the most magical effects," Robert Troup said after the XYZ dispatches appeared. "A spirit of warm and high resentment against the rulers of France has suddenly burst forth in every part of the United States." Congress rushed through a program for fortifying eastern seaports and augmenting the army and navy. The Republicans contrived ways to rationalize what had happened. Jefferson complained to Madison that Adams had perpetrated a libel on the French government as part of his swindling experiment. He conceded that Talleyrand might have organized an extortion plot, but that the Directory knew anything of it is neither proved nor provable. Jefferson's conviction that the XYZ affair was a Federalist hoax only grew with time. "The whole brouhaha was a dish cooked up by John Marshall, where the swindlers are made to appear as the French government." Nor did the XYZ affair lead Madison to reevaluate the French Revolution. After hearing of Talleyrand's conduct toward the American envoys, Madison could not believe that the French minister had behaved so stupidly. He thought President Adams, not the Directory, the great obstacle to accommodation, and accused the Federalists of resorting to vile insults and calumnies to foment war with France. Some Republican papers had the temerity to blame the XYZ affair on Hamilton. The Aurora said the whole fiasco resulted from his relationship with Talleyrand. "Mr. Talleyrand is notoriously anti-Republican. He was the intimate friend of Mr. Hamilton and other great Federalists, and it is probably owing to the determined hostility which he discovered in them towards France that the government of that country consider us only as objects of plunder." This must have been hard for Hamilton to swallow. For years, he had accused France of being a faithless friend. Now that the XYZ dispatches had vindicated his judgment, the Republicans chided him instead of admitting their own errors. As was his wont, Hamilton charged into print with a 7-part newspaper series entitled The Stand, in which he advocated the formation of a large army to face down French aggression. When it had been a question of a possible war with Great Britain a few years earlier, Hamilton had been willing to make concessions and negotiate at length to avoid hostilities. But his foreign policy views frequently varied with the situation, and he now adopted a much tougher tone when France was the potential belligerent power. In writing The Stand, Hamilton took dead aim against Republicans who had become apologists for French misbehavior. Such men merit all the detestation of their fellow citizens, and there is no doubt that with time and opportunity, they will merit much more from the offended justice of the laws. Hamilton mocked Jefferson's claim that Talleyrand, not the Directory, was to blame for the XYZ affair. He noted that Talleyrand was the world's most circumspect man and would never have acted without the direct support of the Directory. The recourse to so pitiful an evasion betrays in its author a systematic design to excuse France at all events, to soften a spirit of submission to every violence she may commit, and to prepare the way for implicit subjection to her will. To be the proconsul of a despotic directory over the United States, degraded to the condition of a province, can alone be the criminal, the ignoble aim of so seditious, so prostitute a character. Hamilton's indignation with Jefferson was warranted, but the idea that he wanted to reduce the United States to a French province or that his ideas were criminal was cruelly overblown and reminiscent of the most malicious nonsense heaved at Hamilton himself. The strident tone of The Stand reflects the polarization that had gripped America over the French crisis. Feelings ran so high that Jefferson told one correspondent, "Men who have been intimate all their lives cross the street to avoid meeting and turn their heads another way, lest they should be obliged to touch hats." Hamilton thought that America was in an undeclared civil war that had segregated the country into two warring camps. At first, the XYZ affair seemed a windfall for the Federalists, and their fortunes improved sharply in elections that fall. Having been strong in the patrician Senate, they now made sweeping gains in the House and even picked up southern seats. But this sudden flush of power in time proved perilous for the Federalists, for they were henceforth to lack the self-restraint necessary to curtail their more dogmatic authoritarian impulses, thus paving the way for abuses of power. As he braced for potential conflict with France, President Adams had to cope with the ambivalent emotions Americans brought to the vexed subject of war. As colonists, they had been antagonized by the need to quarter and provision redcoats and remembered the arrogance of the standing armies sent to enforce hated laws. Among the fanciful dreams fostered by American independence was the fond hope that America would be spared wars and the need for a permanent military presence. "At the close of our Revolutionary War," wrote Hamilton, "the phantom of perpetual peace danced before the eyes of everybody." Gordon Wood has observed, "Since war was promoted by the dynastic ambitions, the bloated bureaucracy, and the standing armies of monarchies, then the elimination of monarchy would mean the elimination of war itself." Hamilton, by contrast, believed that war was a permanent feature of human societies. Many Republicans deplored standing armies as tools used by oppressive kings to subdue popular legislatures. The Declaration of Independence had protested standing armies kept in the colonies in peacetime. At the Constitutional Convention, Elbridge Gerry had bawdily likened standing armies to a tumescent penis. "An excellent assurance of domestic tranquility, but a dangerous temptation to foreign adventure." Jefferson wanted to ban standing armies in the Bill of Rights. He thought state militia and small gunboats sufficient to guard American shores. Republican orthodoxy declared that citizen soldiers could defend the nation and obviate the need for a permanent military. Jeffersonians also feared that war would engender the powerful central government favored by Hamilton. In Madison's view, war is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. Unlike many Federalists, John Adams thought a navy and militia would suffice to guard the country and feared a large standing army as a many-bellied monster. Hobbled by this aversion to a federal military, the country was reduced to a regular army of just a few thousand troops when Washington left office. During the Revolution, Hamilton had despaired of reliance on militia and learned to respect the superiority of trained soldiers. During the war scare with France, he saw a chance to promote a robust national defense and advance a pet project for a 50,000-man army. 20,000 regulars joined by 30,000 auxiliaries. The president reacted with contempt. "The army of 50,000 men appeared to me to be one of the wildest extravagances of a knight errant," Adams later wrote, harping again on Hamilton's foreign birth. "It proved to me that Mr. Hamilton knew no more of the sentiments and feelings of the people of America than he did of those of the inhabitants of one of the planets." As far as Adams was concerned, Hamilton's hobby was the army. Hamilton's blood boiled as France grew more audacious in attacking American ships. In May 1798, a French privateer captured American vessels outside New York Harbor. "This is too much humiliation after all that has passed," Hamilton protested to Secretary of War McHenry. "Our merchants are very indignant. Our government is very prostrate in the view of every man of energy." That month, amid growing fears of an imminent French invasion, Congress decided to create a separate Navy department with 12 new frigates and a provisional army of 10,000 men. The euphemistic language was significant. A permanent or standing army was anathema. In July, Congress provided for an additional army of 12 infantry regiments and 6 cavalry companies. These numbers exceeded what Adams wanted, though they fell short of Hamilton's fantasies. Adams, who sometimes portrayed himself as a passive spectator of his presidency, blamed Hamilton for pushing through this larger army. "Such was the influence of Mr. Hamilton in Congress that without any recommendation from the president, they passed a bill to raise an army." As war hysteria grew, trade with France was embargoed, and American naval vessels were empowered to pounce on any French ships threatening American trade. The so-called quasi-war with France was underway. It proved impossible to separate the war from partisan domestic wrangles. Republicans feared that the unacknowledged agenda behind this burgeoning military establishment was not to defend America from France so much as to save America for the Federalists and stifle domestic dissent. Sometimes Hamilton had trouble keeping the issues apart in his mind because he thought that if France invaded, many Jeffersonians would aid the interlopers and flock to the standard of France to render it easy to quell the resistance of the rest. Hamilton hovered in a queer limbo during this period. He felt both powerful and powerless. He was a private citizen and lawyer, yet alleged by some to be more influential than the president himself. He certainly had unparalleled access to Adams's cabinet and often sent them letters that they repeated verbatim in memos for the president without identifying Hamilton as the source. At the same time, Hamilton struggled to redeem his reputation after the disclosure of his assignations with Mariah Reynolds. Writing to Rufus King, Robert Troup noted the paradox that Hamilton's legal practice was extensive and lucrative, but that he was still under siege from the scandal. "For this 12-month past, this poor man, Hamilton, I mean, has been most violently and infamously abused by the Democratical Party. His ill-judged pamphlet has done him incomparable injury." One might have thought that Hamilton would crow in triumph after Congress approved a new army. Surely he was slated for a commanding position. Instead, in personal letters to Eliza, he again sounded weary of public life and hankered for a more retired existence. When Eliza went off to Albany in early June 1798, leaving him with the older boys, Hamilton seemed incurably lonesome. "I always feel how necessary you are to me," he wrote to her. "But when you are absent, I become still more sensible of it and look around in vain for that satisfaction which you alone can bestow." More than at any time since their courtship, Hamilton showed his deep emotional dependence upon his wife. She provided a psychological anchor for this turbulent man who was disenchanted with public life. "In proportion as I discover the worthlessness of other pursuits," he wrote to Eliza, "the value of my Eliza and of domestic happiness rises in my estimation." One suspects that Alexander and Eliza had slowly repaired the harm done by the Reynolds affair, that she had begun to forgive him, and that they had recaptured some earlier intimacy. Perhaps it took this scandal for Hamilton to recognize just how vital his wife had been in providing solace from his controversial political career. By 1798, many people were trying to woo Hamilton back into public life. When one of New York's two senators resigned, Governor John Jay offered the post to Hamilton. "If, after well considering the subject, you should decline an appointment," he told Hamilton obligingly, "be so good as to consult with some of our most judicious friends and advise me as to the persons most proper to appoint." Congressman Robert G. Harper, a South Carolina Federalist, dangled before Hamilton the prospect of becoming Secretary of War, hinting that he had sounded out President Adams on the subject. Both times, Hamilton declined, for he was stalking bigger game. For someone of his vaulting ambition, the leadership of the new army was a shiny, irresistible lure, especially with the presidency foreclosed. Fisher Ames said that the only distinction that Hamilton devoutly craved was not money or power, but military fame. He was qualified beyond any man of the age to display the talents of a great general. Many Federalists assumed that if France attacked America, Washington would head the war effort with Hamilton loyally at his side in a rousing reenactment of the Revolution. "The old chief is again furbishing his sword," Robert Troop reported excitedly to Rufus King. "If there be a conflict and he is invited, he will take the field, and so will Hamilton." On military matters, John Adams was often adrift. For all his dogged committee work in the Continental Congress and sturdy promotion of an American fleet, he had not experienced combat and perhaps felt deprived of some essential glory. "Oh, that I was a soldier," he had written in 1775. "I will be. I am reading military books. Everybody must and will and shall be a soldier." The fraternal bond that knit Washington and his former officers into an elite caste excluded Adams. In matters of war, nobody could possibly measure up to the exalted Washington who would be needed to confer legitimacy on any new army. After Congress authorized the Provisional Army, Hamilton beseeched Washington to take the lead. He again exhibited perfect pitch in addressing his mentor. "You ought also to be aware, my dear sir," Hamilton told him, "that in the event of an open rupture with France, the public voice will again call you to command the armies of your country." Washington's friends were reluctant to summon him from retirement, yet it is the opinion of all those with whom I converse that you will be compelled to make the sacrifice. Now somewhat infirm at 66, Washington thought the military required an able man in his prime. "Should he agree to serve," he confided to Hamilton, "I should like previously to know who would be my coadjutors and whether you would be disposed to take an active part if arms are resorted to." Washington signed the letter, "Your affectionate friend and obedient servant," a style that underscored their new peer relationship. So, without prompting, Washington made Hamilton's cooperation a precondition for heading the new army. On June 2nd, Hamilton informed Washington that he would join the army only if given the number 2 post. "If you command, the place in which I should hope to be most useful is that of Inspector General, with a command in the line. This I would accept." The Inspector General would be the second spot, carrying the rank and pay of Major General. Since Washington expected any French invasion force to be far more mobile and daring than the stodgy British armies he had fought during the Revolution, he thought the Inspector General should be an energetic young man, and Hamilton was his undisputed choice. During the next few weeks, Hamilton sent a flurry of messages to Adams's cabinet about war preparations. He tossed off stiffly worded dispatches as if he were the president in absentia. Flashing, as usual, with a surplus of ideas, he told Treasury Secretary Wilcott that the United States should boost taxes, take out a large loan, and establish an academy for naval and military instruction. He furnished a precise description of the new navy he envisioned. 6 ships of the line, 12 frigates, and 20 small vessels. Hamilton was typically quick, clear, and decisive in his recommendations. It is easy to understand why Adams's cabinet warmed to his executive prowess, and equally easy to understand why Adams resented his high-handed intrusion. The flinty Timothy Pickering later recounted 3 testy exchanges with Adams as to who should supervise the new army. Adams: "Whom shall we appoint commander-in-chief?" Pickering: "Colonel Hamilton." Then, on a subsequent day, Adams: "Whom shall we appoint commander-in-chief?" Pickering: "Colonel Hamilton." Then, on a third day, Adams, whom shall we appoint commander-in-chief? Pickering, Colonel Hamilton. Adams, oh no, it is not his turn by a great deal. I would sooner appoint Gates or Lincoln or Morgan. Adams preferred these three senior veterans of the Battle of Saratoga. Pickering explained wearily to Adams that the ailing Daniel Morgan had one foot in the grave, that Horatio Gates was an old woman, and that Benjamin Lincoln was always asleep. Pickering later drew the moral for Hamilton's son. It was from these occurrences that I first learned Mr. Adams's extreme aversion to or hatred of your father. Such petulant talks occurred 2 years before Adams's discovery of Hamilton's influence over his cabinet. On June 22nd, President Adams sent an ambiguously worded inquiry to Washington, asking for advice about leadership of any new army. In forming an army, whenever I must come to that extremity, I am at an immense loss whether to call out the old generals or to appoint a young set. End of Disc 22.